Southern FM. Welcome to Covering the Canvas. I'm your host, Jesse Beer, joined here by the Covering the Canvas team. I am joined by Australian wrestling legend, pillar, saviour, showstopper, main event, icon, 1989 Market Square Lego Builder winner, and all-round nice guy, Shane Hero.
Thank you. I love that intro. Brilliant.
One of those fancy haircuts and nephew of Chuck Norris, Commissioner Norris.
I'm here. I'm watching you.
Man with a camera and one of Australia's best photographers and also one of the handful of British people in Australia, Steve Bradford.
Hello.
And we are privileged enough tonight to be joined by one of Australian wrestling legend, pillar, saviour, showstopper, main event, icon.
You just have to check Australian wrestling?
And legend.
Why has we brought this guy in here? I'm asking a similar question myself.
I thought the funny gimmick would be to read your thing. We're no cost spared here at Covering the Canvas.
Someone who's achieved slightly more than Shane Hero in Australian wrestling.
You can't read out the same intro for two people. It's just lame.
Oh, well. Well, the point being, we are joined here by none other than Crackerjack. Thank you for coming out to beautiful freezing Werribee tonight.
It's goddamn horrible. I hate you all. Especially after that introduction. We're off on a bad foot.
How's everyone feeling tonight?
Fantastic.
Good. Cold?
We're not in here, obviously.
Give us a call on 9919-8089. Now, Crackerjack, you're a more than a 15-year veteran of Australian wrestling. Where do you originally get started?
I started in the Diamond Dungeon of Excellence back in late 99, early 2000, which was run by a second-generation wrestler called Ricky Diamond, younger brother of Sydney wrestler Alan Dunlop. And so I started there with a whole bunch of guys, most of whom have vanished into the ether. I think the only guy from those days still going now would be Cletus.
Oh, cool.
Who was a tiny child at the time. Yeah. I'm a bit older than he is. And the rest have all sort of come and gone and stuff. I think that's everyone's story who started training at some point. So we were there for a while. It was basically judo mats out the back of an old school bodybuilder's gym in Richmond. So it was still fun, but getting your head around psychology and bumps and stuff like that. But ring work was something else entirely. So I'm sure there are old VHS copies of people training matches where you just sort of get whipped and you run for a bit and then just slowly turn around and run back. So I didn't get a lot of ring time except like when the ring was set up before shows until I started going down to George's, old man George Julio, who anyone who's heard this show has obviously heard him talk about before, because not many guys in Victorian wrestling have not passed through his gym at some point.
What age were you when you first started training?
I was 20.
So in your mind was this, now we look back and it's a few mats in the back of a building, but in your mind was it amazing to see something like that? And someone giving you the opportunity to bump and jump around?
I sort of came in a lot more adult than a lot of people start. Because, half the guys I'm working with today started when they were 15. So, you know, I was kind of like a grown-up and also not a retard. So I had a healthy degree of cynicism about all of it. Like, I respected the craft and stuff, but I was under no illusions that, we were on judo mats with a bunch of guys who, you know, did not look like athletes. And, I thought Diamond was a good trainer and a good technician, but he didn't look like an athlete. Like, it wasn't really until you got to George's and you saw grizzled old man George.
Yeah.
Who, he would have been 50-something at the time and he still had a superior physique to most of the young guys coming up. So
yeah.
Like, to this day, he still has a superior physique to half the guys who were still wrestling.
He does. I mean, it's not like it was, I think, for a variety of reasons. There's a lot, the physiques of workers in general have improved significantly. Mm. But, I was kind of cynical about it. But, again, I really wanted to do it. It was still exciting.
Yeah. So you go from George's. Were you still training at George's or were you wrestling at that stage? Were you being booked?
I think I trained for about 7 months and then I started getting matches. Like, it's like a lot of people. It's your first match usually, unless it's a very well-organized thing and you're being brought in and groomed as such. It's usually someone else gets sick or dies or pulls out or whatever, and that's your time. And so my first match was on a fundraising show for the Starlight Foundation, wrestling some 200-kilo pro shoot fighter who'd never had a wrestling match in his life, but his sister had benefited from the charity, so he wanted to be on it. So Maori warrior King Haka was booking it, and he dragged me in to put this guy over. And I didn't know what I was doing, and he didn't know what he was doing. But in training, I took about a dozen side belly-to-belly suplexes until the meat on the back of my arm started to split from the landings. I got through it okay. I did almost fall out of the ring during my introduction, though. Too much energy.
So you're really known for deathmatch wrestling. Well, not necessarily just deathmatch wrestling, but you're one of the pillars of Australian wrestling who do partake in deathmatch wrestling. Mm-hmm. When do you start to make the move from normal wrestling? I sound very offensive when I'm saying this.
You're dancing around. Watch!
So when do you go from not deathmatch wrestling to deathmatch wrestling? It was someone in your ear and were like, hey, maybe you should try this. It's a better payday, or...
No, it wasn't that.
It's Australian wrestling, yeah.
I liked the hardcore stuff. Like guys I was into coming in... you know, past the sort of 80s guys like Piper and Savage were dudes like Cactus and Sabu. So I thought that stuff was cool as. So I was always kind of down for it. And then sort of coming in and sort of being faced with the physical reality of just regular wrestling, like normal matches, I was like, maybe that's not for me. I don't see a future in which I'm... It sounds hilarious. That I don't see a future in which Cracker Jack is bleeding all over rings in Australia. That's crazy talk. Yeah, and so I did a few hardcore spots here and there as they came up. But, I mean, even then, my first hardcore match was, of course, against Mad Dog McRae.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where it wasn't meant to be that hardcore. Like, I'd never bled in a match, and I'd never used tacks or barbed wire or any of that. So Mad Dog's like, no, that's cool. Tacks and barbed wire, leave them to me. It was at the Ukrainian Club in Essendon where MCW was back working now. This is about 15 years ago for PCW. The promoter had organized an indestructible table for us. Like, clearly, it was he saved $8 and he bought a sheet of high-density MDF instead of chipboard. And it weighed as much as a refrigerator, and it was indestructible. Like, everything went wrong in this match. This should have been the match that stopped me from ever doing hardcore again. The table's set up in the ring. I'm on the top rope. Mad Dog throws a chair at me. I fall backwards onto the table and bounce off it. And then it rolls over onto me, pinning me to the canvas.
Here's your winner, the table.
Yes, I was face down. It was okay. Mad Dog gets up, sets me up on the table. He wraps 30 meters of barbed wire around his legs and leg drops me. The table legs collapse. We now have a large two-dimensional rectangle that we can't break. And the wire can't come out from Mad Dog's legs. It's wrapped up in his jeans. And for the rest of his match, he has about 15 meters of wire trailing behind him. The thumbtacks come out. I go to suplex him into the tacks because it's his bump, damn it. The wire in his legs catches in the ropes, pulls him up short directly above me, and he just falls onto me, trapping me between his husky body and the thumbtacks. I took all of them. It was a shambles. I landed on my head, taking a backdrop into the corner on a ladder, and just sort of slid down it and grated all the meat off my back. Afterwards, I'm like, oh, well, if this is as bad as it gets, then I'm totally down for more of that. And it got worse from there, and I ended up doing my first death match with Mad Dog as well. In a show I was running. It wasn't meant to be a death match. It was just meant to be hardcore, and maybe we'd build to that. And Mad Dog's philosophy is always, there may not be another tomorrow, which I think applies to his life and and wrestling. So he's like, why don't we just take the ropes down and do barbed wire ropes? And that was my first death match, was a barbed wire ropes one with a pit of thumbtacks and a pit of light tubes, and then we ran out of light tubes, so the rest of them were just light bulbs.
What goes through your mind when you go to take a deathmatch bump?
Oh, small pieces of glass.
Does your life flash before your eyes every time?
That was quite surreal because, I mean, even just getting into the ring is a bit unusual.
Yeah.
Like, the ring, it's quite a striking space because you're raised up and the audience is down and the ropes are between you and the angles are interesting, which is why anytime a fan gets in the ring, they're always, ooh, this is really weird, it's exciting, and they're looking around and stuff. But replacing those with wires was totally bizarre. Like, just getting in the ring, I had to bundle my hair up in my mouth just to not get caught them.
Because I remember back when they did that at ECW, they said it was insane because like the ropes kept collapsing and breaking through and stuff, and then eventually it just became a canvas.
The ropes didn't collapse.
No, didn't break away.
No, a friend of mine named Rob, who organized the fencing for us, had like the material you would use to fence a farm. So they were incredibly tight. Like the tension was incredible. Mm. We had to cut them at one point, and they were strung so tightly that when we cut one of the strands, it went pa-pow and shot straight towards the cameraman. It was almost sliced in half.
So myself, I'm a huge deathmatch wrestling fan, and I'm a very big fan of Necro Butcher. And when he came out to Perth in 2011, I believe, and
yes, that sounds right,
wrestled you. I've spoken to you about it before, and you said it was an awesome match. I've seen it back. I wish I could have seen it. I would have been 13 at the time, probably conning my dad and be like, "Dad, let's just drive to Perth.
It's a family show. It'll be fine."
Yeah, it's like 14 hours. It's nothing, Dad. What was going through your mind when you get to wrestle someone who's a deathmatch legend?
It was pretty exciting. I mean, I got to wrestle Pondo, Madman Pondo, a few years earlier, but I hadn't been a fan of his up front. You know, when he was out, I watched some of his matches and stuff and was like, oh, okay, cool, that's what I'm into. Whereas, obviously, Necro has a much greater mystique about him. And he also, you get the cache of when you're talking to non-wrestling fans, you can say, you know, the wrestler, the movie, the bald guy who almost kills Mickey Rourke. And, oh wow, is that a real guy? Yeah. And he's that insane. So it was quite intimidating. He's pretty easygoing in person, but I think like a lot of guys who are the most sort of charming philosophical people in person, and then the bell rings and they turn into a goddamn lunatic.
Yeah, he almost killed you with the chairs.
Honestly, I found, like, for a guy who, I mean, you know, deathmatch guys, especially guys who make a name in deathmatch, often sort of get tarnished for their work rate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, especially by wrestling purists, they end up being sort of, you know, tarred with the garbage brush. And I think Necro is one of those guys who's definitely suffered from that. And I think maybe in part it's because when you're a hardcore guy and you go from town to town, promotions put you with their hardcore guy, who usually is a terrible wrestler who just doesn't care if he gets hurt or not. Mm. And Necro had just come from a show in Mexico where he'd been in the ring with three guys who were barely trained, and it was just chaos and stuff. And so I think he was excited to find out that I was actually a wrestler and you had to wrestle. He's trying to teach me the finish, and he's like, you know, what we'll do, I'll get you up for a superplex. And I can't do his voice. It's kind of like Hogan if he came from the woods. and then you push me down, and you slide over my back, and I'll hold onto the buckle until it's time for the power bomb. Are you talking about a sunset bomb? Yeah, you know it. Yeah, you know, I'm like a worker. I'm oh, thank Christ. Oh, I saw the scars and I thought, yeah.
Thought you were just a murderer.
Yeah, you thought I was another garbage guy. I'm like, no, we'll like be safe and stuff and we'll do moves and tell a story. And he was overjoyed. And he was safe. He hit damn hard, like hardest chops I've ever taken. Like, and I've wrestled Loki. His chops were the hardest I've ever taken. I was like meat afterwards, but I guess I was more intimidated that I'd just not match up.
Yeah,
like I didn't think I'd screw up and he'd, you know, try to kill me or anything. I didn't think I was in danger as such. I just think there's sort of pressure to deliver and stand up when you're in a ring with a guy like that, with that sort of, you know, tough guy hardcore reputation.
Moving on from the deathmatch stuff, you're very well known for cutting an awesome promo and just entertaining the crowd on the mic. When it comes to it now, do promotions more tell you the point they want to get across and you just take that away and come up with it? Or do you just go out there and
it always rip into the crowd? It always has been like that.
Mm.
I came from sort of a theatrical film theatre background, so I had the talking when I turned up. I mean, obviously I developed it and tailored it for wrestling over the years, but that was my thing to cover my crappy work rate when I came in. And early on, some promotions were micromanaged a little, but PCW was the new upstart, you know, started by people from outside the business, and they ran differently. And one of the things that both co-owners did is they came up to me before shows on separate occasions and said, every time you wrestle, even if we forget to tell you, grab the mic and do a promo. And that's sort of those first couple of years at PCW is where I really cut my teeth. Just every time I just come out and I just wing it. I'd maybe have a line or two or a gag or, you know, maybe something actually relevant to what I was there for. But they weren't storyline-driven promos. They were just, you know, get over and entertain and get good at it. And that made a huge difference. Mm. But, I mean, not many promotions really micromanage anything that happens on the show, so they should. And I do that for other promotions where I'll come in and I'll micromanage things so you don't end up with crap on the show. But there's no one sort of handing people scripts or anything like that. That sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Give us a call at 9919 8089. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back after this.
Hey, this is 2007 Australian Wrestler of the Year, Champagne Pyro, and you're listening to Covering the Canvas on 88.9 Win FM.
Win FM has a new website with a full program guide, streaming links, program pages, and now with podcasts for every show. Check it out at winfm.org.au.
You're listening to 88.9 Win FM Community Radio.
This is Impact Wrestling superstar Rob Terry, and you're listening to Covering the Canvas.
Mr. Juicy, and you're listening to Covering the Canvas.
My wife has been diagnosed with diabetes, and I'm trying to encourage her to get some exercise. How much should she be doing? And how will it help her?
If you have diabetes, you don't need to suddenly start going for long runs or long sessions at the gym. Regular physical activity can become an enjoyable part of your day, resulting in long-term benefits to your diabetes and your overall health. Getting regular physical activity and not smoking are both very important to the health of people with diabetes. Physical activity helps to improve the body's response to insulin, which can lower blood glucose levels. It will also help you to control your weight, lower your blood pressure, and improve your cholesterol, which reduces the risk of heart disease. It's recommended that you aim to spend a total of at least 30 minutes on most, if not all, days of the week, doing some form of moderate intensity physical activity. Remember to talk to your doctor about the types of physical activity that will be best for you.
This program is funded by the Australian Government Department of Health and Ageing.
This is the cremator, Brad Richards. And when I'm not combing my beard, shampooing my beard, looking at my beard, reading Batman comics, I'm listening to 88.9, covering the canvas and crying, wondering what the hell is wrong with my life.
And this is how it starts.
Welcome back to Covering the Canvas. I'm your host, Jesse Beer, joined here by the Covering the Canvas team. And tonight we are joined by none other than Australian wrestling pillar, legend, hardcore wrestler, way more things that Steve's pointing about, Cracker Jack.
Hello again.
Thank you for coming out to beautiful, freezing cold Werribee. Beautiful, that's a very, very stretch word. I don't even think half the people in Werribee could spell beautiful. Loving that demographic.
Who are we playing to again?
Thanks for listening, local radio.
So this is going to sound very out of context, but before we went to, or while we were on the ad break, you were telling us about Mad Dog versus Godzilla.
Yes. The second show I ran at that place where I did the first death match, I always wanted to see Mad Dog versus Godzilla, so I organized a tiny city at ringside and had Godzilla stomping through and then had Mad Dog come out and attack him and suplex him into the buildings before cutting a promo. It's a check, that one.
Now, I remember at the end of that show as well, I was promised that there was going to be a cactus tree death match at the next show. When's the date for the next show, and when can we expect the Cactus Tree?
Oh, beautiful.
Match?
We can plug this right now.
Yeah, I was looking forward to that. It was going to be Mad Dog and I versus Jay Andrews and Mike Manson. But there was like a falling out with the venue, and Wrestle Rock was just starting to take off at the same time. And I thought, you know, it's, and this has been the reason why I don't promote shows and work on other people's shows anyway, is if I can put my energies into making their thing less sucky and, you know, get my own stuff off in there, then why not do that instead of promoting? Because promoting looks like the worst job ever, and in my experience it is. So yeah, I think Mad Dog and I ended up having a death match at Wrestle Rock where we had a cactus in one corner that I stole from you know, sometimes when you're on the train and you go past the station and you go, oh look, there's cactuses. Well, if you were to travel in someone else's car and slide down the ravine with a saw, you could saw off one of those cactuses and put it in the back of the Wrestle Rock promoter's car, so he would be attacked by tiny spores and spikes and spines for the rest of his life when he's driving that car. So that's what we did. I took a pile driver right onto it and had little spiky bits in my head for about a week. So he should have been there.
Damn, I missed it. Yeah. Now, going back a little bit, we did talk about, obviously, you started wrestling. Before you actually did start training, what was sort of the thing that got you interested in wrestling in the very beginning?
Wrestling or Australian wrestling?
Well, I guess wrestling in general. Like a lot of people, it was, you know, they may have grown up watching old WWF videos or something like that. For yourself, what was sort of the thing that sparked an interest in wrestling?
I wasn't a child fan, so I don't have sort of childhood Hulkamania memories, which is probably why I'm not as attached to Hulk Hogan as a lot of other people are. I first got into wrestling when I hired Super WrestleMania on the Super Nintendo. Where everyone has exactly the same moves, but they have different entrance music, and the booklet had all the characters in the back, and I'm like, these guys sound cool. Well, that Undertaker sounds pretty tough. I wonder if he wins all the time. And then and then I went off.
Surely not.
Yeah, and then I bought the latest WWF magazine, which I think had the results of SummerSlam 92 in it, which was, you know, the rise of Bret Hart and Ric Flair and that sort of thing, and went out and hired SummerSlam 91 on video, and I was like, this is the bee's knees, that wedding. It was awesome. Yeah, and so from then I was a fan. And then in 1992, I believe it was, there was a show called Wrestle Right 92, which I got no idea who promoted this. Someone older than me in the scene could tell you. But it was mainly Sydney talent, but with Road Warrior Smash and Hawk and Nails. Yeah, Nails. And the Big Boss Man. And I went along to that. Oh, and that was when I first saw Australian wrestlers, because Mario was there, you know, or even then he'd already, you know, realized that you could get a tremendous, you know, it was easy to monetize wandering around in a burgundy jacket and getting paid for it. So he was there, and Cognac Avedis, who was sort of like a second generation ass-kicking machine, Mr. Damage. Yeah. Yeah, he was on the card as well. And a bunch of nobodies. And I think Mark Mercedes as well, wrestling the Malenkos. And then I'm like, oh, so there's Aussie wrestling too. And then I sort of gave up on being involved in wrestling because I didn't get any taller and they're all giants. And yeah, then they all got smaller because of, you know, the influence of Lucha in Japan and stuff. And I thought, maybe I'm not too small. And then I went to a local wrestling show in about 99 and I went, I'm definitely not too small. Or too fat or too crap. I think I'll be fine. And I started training from there, and I wasn't fine. I obviously got my ass handed to me over and over again until I sort of got my head around it. But yeah, that's the timeline of my wrestling fandom.
And you really did get into wrestling sort of at an interesting time where there was a bit of a transition between sort of the older guard and then the young PCW type kids that were just sort of starting out probably around that time as well. And what was it like for yourself probably sort of coming in the era that you did really get started?
It was exciting times. When I went to local shows for a couple of years before I started training, so sort of 98, 99. And that was sort of just heading into the downturn post mid-90s wrestling explosion, which, you know, obviously came, you know, affected us all down here because we had, you know, cable for the first time and you could watch Nitro and Raw and stuff like that, and the NWO thing was hot. And I'd been to a few of those shows and they just got worse and worse, you know, for reasons, you know, anyone who saw some of those shows in those days would know that for the handful of young talent coming in and the handful of old timers who were really good, tough guys and real characters and it could work, there were just, oh, I'm struggling for the correct pejorative without swearing, but there were just guys who never should have been in the ring, clinging onto the spot that they never should have been given. I mean, that was sort of at a worker level, but at a promoter level, it was still very closed doors, like it had really just been the old guard carrying over from back when it used to be on TV. And the handful of guys, and then they'd split. And so there was, you know, two fat old Italian guys running wrestling shows, and then three. but they all kind of had a link to the old guard. And then out of nowhere, Ken and Ann Rock started PCW, and it was kind of like the first time in Melbourne where someone who wasn't a disgruntled worker starting their own show or wasn't a split off from an existing promotion, they just sort of came in sideways. And it changed the way people ran shows in this town, because suddenly people realized that no one's the boss of wrestling, and you don't have to kowtow to these people and use their guys and their announcers and that sort of thing if you don't want to. You just need the money, and you buy a ring, and then you pay a bunch of guys to turn up and wrestle, and they'll turn up and wrestle. And, I mean, obviously had follow-on effect in that sort of... That making it open to everyone kind of opened it up for cowboys to run terrible shows, and a lot of the shows were terrible anyway. I mean, it's the talent that we got in instead, and the competitiveness from these new shows coming up. It revolutionized wrestling and allowed us to sort of keep up with the rest of the wrestling world as it advanced.
And for a while there, when there was the eventual split off with PCW and PWA. Wrestling in Melbourne, and probably at the time, probably around Australia as well, you had a promotion that you would work for, and you wouldn't cross that line and sort of go and work for someone else. And whereas these days, there's not sort of that strictness where you really would not dare to go and wrestle for different promotions. And you're probably seen as someone who... You do wrestle for a lot of different companies these days, and that's probably an opportunity that earlier on you wouldn't have had.
No, I did. Always been a whore. even those early days when PCW was just starting and I was working for Fat Dom at Dragonfly for ACW and All Star, which was sort of run by, you know, the Rowans and the Chris Freshers and the stuff. These are all names that mean nothing to you if you're not following the scene. But if you're not following the local scene, you don't know who any of us are, and you're not listening, so it doesn't matter. But I was always, no, I want to wrestle more. And you need to when you're starting as well. You just need match after match. Matches against crap guys. Matches in front of no one. You need all those matches to develop your skills. And otherwise, if you only ever wrestle really good opponents, you know, you end up like a Mike Peterson, like a sort of really talented but not used to leading someone beneath you to a good match. You don't develop that skill set if you're always wrestling guys who you are elevated by. So I wanted to work else everywhere, and I always have. I'm not fundamentally opposed to exclusivity, but I think everyone cuts their own deal. Like, it's like match pay or anything else. It's, you know, make it worth my while, and sure, I won't do the other show next week, or I'll pick your show over theirs if they happen to clash. But I've always been a free agent, and no one's ever made it worthwhile to not be. But a lot back then, a lot of the guys didn't. And again, I think that was just me coming in as a grown-up rather than a kid. Yeah. Whereas, you know, in wrestling, some guys, they just want to be little kings. And the only way to be a little king is to get, you know, subject underneath you that you can boss around. And so that's like that with promoters and training schools and just cliques and stuff. One way you can control your boys is to not let them work elsewhere. And so I never had a part of it. It probably cost me a few bookings, but I'd say it probably made me more bookings than it cost me. And the experience it gave me allowed me to progress faster as well.
Mm. And in saying that, you have a unique ability, I've seen, to carry across a persona and a character across different promotions, and you're not necessarily constrained to being, you're that guy here, you're a different guy there. You've got a very consistent character that you managed to portray through different storylines and different promotions. And is that something that's just naturally progressed, or was it something that you've consciously always strived to do?
I'm a big believer. Let me backtrack. I think one of the things that's cool about wrestling as a performer that makes it different from sort of acting or other sort of drama is you get to make your own character, and you get to take them with you. It's not like, you know, you're on a sitcom for a while, or you do a play and then that play's over and you don't get to be Hamlet anymore. You have to be Macbeth. And you can't just, you know, oh, but my Hamlet fans are coming, you know, I want to do that same shtick. But with wrestling, you make your own guy, and especially in the indies, you're a free agent. You can take it everywhere. And I didn't want to have to... Like, some guys have that opening character, like the first wrestling character they come up with, and it's terrible. It's, you know, Johnny Austin, the take no prisoners guy who doesn't care for the boss's orders, and he wears sunglasses, but he's a heel, but he's cool. You know? Johnny Arskick McGee.
That's pretty unique.
And then they drop for a year to everyone, because they come in and the guy's already here, rubbing their hands in anticipation. Oh, he thinks he's someone. I'll show him. You're nobody like me. Like the rest of us nobodies. Whereas I didn't want to have to sort of like be a different guy in a couple of years, so I always had the view of it's Cracker Jack's story, and I started as a 20-year-old kid being, you know, broken in half by Mr. Damage and having terrible matches and some good ones, and I've just kept being that guy, but I evolved with my career and with the scene around me. And as, you know, other guys came and went, and the guys I started with dropped off, and I was sort of, I'm the only one here. And a bunch of kids who came up underneath me all look fitter than me. So it's kind of cool. I kind of kept being me. And it's still kind of the same when I go from promotion to promotion. Although I did do a series of heel turns at last year and the year before. I'd sort of been babyface everywhere. And I'm real big on, you know, be the face, be with the fans, actually appreciate them for coming, don't be too good for it. But it was exhausting, and it was starting to grind me down. And so I went, I want to be heel everywhere. I can't do this anymore. I love these people, but I can't do it anymore. And I wanted to have a different turn at every place and a different reason. And I managed to do that across Warzone, PCW, MCW. There was another one. OCW was the only one I turned face. That was the switcheroo. So that was kind of cool. And I got to, and made a point of being a slightly different heel at each one. And that was sort of partly, I guess, as a reward for anyone who's coming to all the shows, so they don't have to see me do exactly the same shtick at each one. And also for myself, just to keep it interesting and to challenge myself.
Yeah. And another thing that I've seen over the years of watching you is, in that time, very consistent ring attire. The tights. I've seen a number of different pairs of bastard tights, but a very consistent design. Is there any significance to the famous bastard design on the tights?
I don't think there's significance to the design itself. I think it's more been about just consistency of branding. And that's something I sort of worked out very early on. And one of the guys I dealt with a lot coming in, he was gone within about a year of me coming in. He was like this giant islander from New Zealand called King Haka, who I once saw have the most awesome match with Mario Milano ever that I'll cover at the end if we've got time. But he was always, you know, it's pick, you may be able to do 20 moves, pick 10, do 5 of them every match. You know, don't chop, punch, kick, pick a strike. And it was always very big on branding and sort of being instantly identifiable. Because if you're Joe Average and you come to a show, it's just a bunch of guys who come out. There was the bald guy. Oh, there were 4 bald guys. The one with the beard. 2 of them had beards. The one in jeans. They all wore jeans. I don't know. He came out to that song I like. And that's how people sort of remember guys. And so you've got to stand out and you've got to be recognizable everywhere you go. And so I started off in shorts and a t-shirt just because I was scared about wearing tights. And then I got my first pair of tights, and it's, if you've never worn spandex before, I recommend it. It's tremendously liberating. It's like being naked but with your hands in your pockets. I heartily recommend it. And so once I went spandex, there was no going back. And so I sort of made a point of just keeping the design consistent. I've had 4 pairs of tights. The first just got really old. The second pair I'm still wearing from time to time. They were triple layered and made by a corset seamstress, so they're indestructible. I wear them on hardcore matches now because, you know, anyone can wear jeans in a hardcore match, but, you know, wear tights in there and roll around on sharp stuff. You're a tough guy. I got another pair that I melted on the clothesline. I put it, like, you're not meant to put them out in the sun, right? I put it on the clothes horse in the afternoon sun, and somehow they got so hot that they melted through the bars. I was heartbroken because I'm such a deadbeat. I only had 1 pair of tights at any given time. No! I tried to wear them. They're all crispy. It was like I had dried leaves down the front of my pants. I couldn't wear them. So, and I got a new pair. The last 2 were from AWP, but I really should lash out in variety. But yeah, branding. Same music. I've been using that little cracker jingle that I stole from the Cracker Jack Candy Snack Foods since my 3rd match or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Jeez. I've changed the song that came after it a couple of times. But and then I found that Mr. Bungle riff that I sort of chopped together into a suitable thing. Please don't sue me, Warner Brothers. You can come for half of all my earnings. All right, it'll fit in a very small envelope. Yeah, and so I've been using that ever since. And it's anything that makes them remember you and makes it easier to hook onto what you do and what you're about.
Mm. Give us a call at 9919-8089. We're going to take our final break and we'll be back after this.
And you're listening to Covering the Canvas on 88.9 Win FM.
Deep in the heart of the Yarra Valley, Victoria, there's a place that special needs animals call home. Gunya Animal Healing Sanctuary is no ordinary place. It is a fully registered charity, but from the moment that you enter Gunya, you can feel there's something different in the air. Maybe it's the interspecies communication. The alpacas, the sheep, the horses, miniature ponies, dogs and cats all live in harmony. There are no barriers, and all these animals know and appreciate that without Gunya, they simply would have no place to live. It takes love, patience, and money to keep this sanctuary operational and to keep these animals under one roof. Without any government funding, Gunya needs your help, and it needs it now. Please help by donating at www.gunya.org. All donations over $2 are tax deductible. On behalf of the animals at Gunya, Thank you.
Tune in every Friday from 6 p.m. for the latest in Tamil news with Kumar, Pat, Melian and Deb.
Join us as we discuss the latest issues which impact your Tamil community.
From the latest events around the globe to what's happening in your own backyard.
You also get to hear the best Tamil music from the 1960s all the way through to today.
So make sure you tune in every week.
Fridays from 6 p.m. on your station, Your Voice, 88.9 minutes.
If you like what you're hearing and want to be a part of Win FM, then the Win FM Training School is for you. We are seeking interested people who have exciting new program ideas which cater for the needs of our local community. Our training courses are designed to prepare you to present your choice of program at Win FM Community Radio. If you are interested in presenting a program, email training@winfm.org.au or contact the secretary by mail at PO Box 155, Werribee 3030.
This is Josh Shooter trying to make a bit of extra money at the gimme table, and you're listening to 88.9 Win FM, Sound of the West. Just give me a try.
Welcome back to Covering the Canvas. I'm your host, Jess Beard, joined here by the Covering the Canvas team. And we are pleasured tonight to be joined by the mad bastard, Crackerjack. Pleasured.
I'm reaching under the table as we speak.
Ooh.
That wasn't meant that I did come here.
So before we went to the break, you were talking about an amazing match between Mario Milano and King Haka.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, so Mario Milano, Mario Milano is great because he's one of those guys where you say, I'm involved in wrestling, and they go, like the Olympics? And you go, no. And they go, like Hulk Hogan? And you're there, that's it. But one of the other names that would always come back at you in this country is Mario Milano, because he was, you know, back in the 70s, we had a lot of American stars coming out, but he was our biggest local guy, and he was like a huge ethnic hero as well. But he was still around when I was coming in, which is kind of awesome, actually. Like, I was sharing locker rooms with Mario Milano at the prestigious Dragonfly restaurant on their nights off from hosting the Denise Drysdale show, or Manpower, or Real Diamond, the Neil Diamond impersonator. So on this night, I had a bunch of wrestling impersonators in instead. Yeah, and so King Harker had been brought in to job out to Mario Milano, and I couldn't tell whether Harker was taking the piss or not, because he's like, of course I've got the legend tonight, and kept referring him to as a legend. He kicked the bejesus out of Mario Milano. Mario must have been pushing 60 at the time. He's a big man. Like, he was about 6'6", 6'7", or something, but he was still like a big old man in these underpants. And this 25-year-old Maori warrior kicked the Christ out of him. Threw him, double him over. He hits the ropes and gives him an axe kick with his giant wooden Maori foot. Damn near killed him. He fell like an ox, like he'd been. And Mario's getting up. He doesn't know what the hell's going on. No one's hit him properly for about 10 years. And he turns around and Harker's coming off the top rope, a 150-kilo man with a missile drop kick, flattens him, chops him and strikes him and pulls his face off for another 5 minutes, and then finds himself trapped in the abdominal stretch and taps out immediately. Ah, you got me.
The old abdominal stretch.
Yeah, it was amazing. I'd never seen a guy do that. Beat the crap out of a legend, totally job out to him at the end, and then act like nothing out of the norm happened. Because I saw a few more Mario matches before he finished up, and none of them were like that.
So you made a point before about you being a free agent. I'm just wondering, what are some of the like little strange shows that you've been on with very strange matches or strange venues and stuff like that?
Usually they're just really poorly attended.
Yeah.
Like, and that's why I've sort of gotten a bit more picky in the last few years. There was a while there where I thought every show that exists, it should have me on it to better it. And it's particularly the, like, you want to be on the shows with all the good guys because they're all the good guys and you'll have a good match, and if it's well promoted there'll be lots of people there. But I'd also want to be on the crappy shows, because on the off chance that anyone actually showed up, I'd want them to see one good wrestler. And so they'd walk away going, well, that was the Drizzling Poos, but that Crackers, he was pretty good. I'd see another show if I saw him on it.
Yeah.
And so it was like me doing it for the scene, basically, in my own ego. And I was doing dumb stuff, like I was wrestling injured. I did a series of matches with a broken foot in a space boot, so one of my legs was longer than the other. I was watching back some old WrestleRock matches recently for like a Best of Crackers thing they were doing. I'm like, why haven't I run the ropes once? I'm just reversing all the way. I've got a space boot on that I'd ingeniously disguised with a black sock and stuff, and made one of my legs like 4 inches longer than the other. It almost crippled me working with that. But yeah, so a lot of the times there were just no one there. We all got in a car and drove all the way to Mount Gambier for a show in front of about 30 people. It was my first bomb scare show. Like, I'd done shows that hadn't done well, and I've done plenty since. But that was the first time where we got there, and you get to the town and there's no posters up, and you walk in and people are like, oh, what are you guys here from? Because it's a small town, everyone knows each other. We're here for the wrestling. Oh, is there wrestling? Oh, Christ. Because the model for regional touring or rural touring is you bombard the place. You make it like the carnival's coming to town. It's the biggest thing that's going to happen to this town this year. It's yep. The model that PCW do for their Wollongong shows.
Yeah.
Warrnambool.
Warrnambool, yeah, I was going to say.
But yeah, you make it a huge event. And so we wrestled in front of 30 people. I wrestled the cremator. We brawled through the crowd. It was awesome. I was walking through empty chairs saying, get out of the way! Your own safety! Sat down and one of them, hey, check it out. I'm someone who's not here tonight. Yeah, poor promoter. He's going to pay us, right? Yeah, he's going to pay us. But usually they're just rubbish shows. We did a show in a fishing shack in Greensboro where there was like a section of the ceiling that came down over the ring. So it basically just quartered off one third of the ring, so you could kind of run side to side, but not in and out or across. So my brother and I were wrestling the guys who organized that venue, so we made a point of power bombing them into the wall partition over and over again. Wrestled outside a few times. That usually sucks. Street festivals, that sort of thing. I'm just trying to think of like the fact that, you know, the majority of my career took place in a Chinese restaurant alone sounds pretty weird. I mean, we've had Americans come down. I think Paul London was like, I've wrestled in some weird places, but never a Chinese restaurant. That's awesome.
Just you wait until you get the food afterwards, Paul.
Yeah. They don't bring us the stuff they sell. That's for all the worst. But yeah, usually just crap shows rather than remarkable ones.
Before we take off, I want to touch on the SBS documentary Sweat, Spandex, Sweat, Scars and Spandex.
Yes.
How did you get involved in that? Did someone just...
I'd been contacted by Nicole Presser, I'm getting her surname wrong probably, Nicole from The Feed had contacted me via my fan page, and I get so many of these things that I sort of go, yeah, sure, I'll get right on it. I'll do your dinky little podcast. I mean, it'll took me a year to get on here. half the time it ends up being like an interview for their school project or something. And they'll send me like three, they go, what's being a wrestler like? And I'll send them to 4 pages about the business and the harrowing life I've led and stuff. And they have to sort of condense it into a 500-word essay for their year 7 assignment. And so I hadn't gotten back to her. And then she'd contacted PCW because she'd seen me on their page because I was working there at the time. And I think the promoters of PCW were like, we'll take this for us and promote it. And she was like, no, I really want to talk to Crackerjack. I want to talk to him about the hardcore stuff. And so through PCW, it became more about myself and Daniel Swagger. Yeah. And it was kind of, don't push the hardcore stuff, which is fine. I mean, if it's going to be associated with a company's brand, I don't want to go out and say, Deathmatch is right on, we do them all the time, when that's not something that's part of their product. But it was cool. You're trying to be a bit cagey with those sort of things, because, I mean, you guys, you're pretty much insiders. So it's not like... there's not that thing where sort of you deal with the mainstream media and there's a chance that they'll try to take the piss or take advantage.
Yeah,
of you.
That's yeah, yeah, like silly sort of guys thing, tackling each other. Yeah,
make you look like fools. And
which seems to be that's what mainstream media did for a while.
Look, partly it's the problem of the people you put in there with them.
Yeah,
like it's, you know, we don't have the capacity for media training. So whenever there's an opportunity for that, partly because I want to get my colossal head on camera, but also just because I want to see it handled well and want to make sure,
yeah,
I'm like fools, as I always put my hand up for that sort of stuff. Because you need to be kind of cagey, or you'll be made to look like a fool, or to say something, or you'll find yourself representing yourselves wrong. But I mean, they probed pretty deep, but they were pretty respectful about the whole thing. And it's kind of cool when you sort of see over the course of several weeks shooting, you see their understanding of what it is we do, sort of coalescing in their minds, and you sort of watch them learn that appreciation because they come into it. I mean, most people. A lot of people don't even watch wrestling. A lot of people's understanding of pro wrestling doesn't even come from that one match they saw. It comes from that time they saw a parody of wrestling on some other show, which is why you always see weird stuff like wrestling matches ending with standing 10 counts on TV and stuff like that. It's like, what wrestling match is this? Two guys who aren't even wrestlers pretending to wrestle. Like, you could have got anyone from the indies for half for a pineapple. And instead you hire two like bodybuilders to pretend to wrestle and it doesn't even look like it. So, yeah, they don't get it. It's sort of... And be careful how you educate them.
Yeah. Did you find yourself getting noticed after that? Because it is, SBS is pretty mainstream.
Look, I mean, after this and the match with Dicko for WrestleRock and...
Because that was pretty big as well.
The Vega FM stuff and the game shows and the TV shows and the Guinness thing and stuff. You sort of come to realize that none of it's going to break.
Mm.
At the end of the day, you're not going to get famous and there's not going to be a significant tip in terms of your profile if you're still associated with a thing that a lot of people aren't interested in or watching. And at the end of the day, I'm still an Australian wrestler.
Mm.
I may be, arguably, the most famous Australian wrestler in the country who hasn't gone overseas or done anything better with his life, besides Iron J, obviously, because he's got that lucrative fish deal, the bastard. But again, I mean, that just means if you know Aussie wrestling, you know who I am. But if you don't know Aussie wrestling, you don't know who I am and you won't. And long ago, I stopped thinking that, oh, this is the one. I can't wait for some of them internet bucks to start rolling in now that have done that podcast. So I don't think of it in those terms. It's kind of good for me and it's good for my own show reel and promoting myself. But you stop thinking that it's going to be the thing that leads to bigger things. Mm. If you want bigger things, you've got to get out of Aussie wrestling.
Mm. Yep. So where can people get in contact with you? What's your Facebook page?
What is it? WWE Facebook / Crackerjack. I spell my name KrackerJack, which was a terrible idea, and it just means that people misspell my name all the time because I misspelled it because the word Crackerjack is spelled totally differently. The easiest way to find me is at mangoat.com, which is my website. So it's MANNGOAT.com, and that's where all my stuff is. Actually, I haven't updated it in ages. I've been very busy. I was lost at sea. But I'm going to get right on it. It's got my matches and my other side projects and weird stuff I get up to.
Beautiful. This has been Covering the Canvas. Same time next week.
Yo, man.
Yo,
open up, man.
What do you want, man?
My girl just caught me.
You made her catch?
I don't know how I let this happen.
But who?
The girl next door, you know? I don't know what to do.
So it wasn't you.
Alright. Money came in and she got me ready.